We've got Clayton Peters on the podcast, manager and older brother of comedy icon Russell Peters. And what really struck me in this conversation is when I asked Clayton what would ever happen if Russell wanted a different manager, Clayton really came through with the answer of, you know, he wants the best for his brother. For him, it's about family. And on his father's deathbed, his father said to him, take care of your younger brother. These are two guys from Brampton, and Russell's been selling out arenas across the globe. They've been together for 20 years as a manager-client duo. Next up, Clayton Peters. Enjoy the episode.
Hey, I'm Jordan Harding. I grew up watching my dad put on that suit and tie every morning and go out to successfully climb the corporate ladder. I thought I wanted to be him, but I was wrong. I needed to be me. To do that, I had conversations with incredible people to learn how they figured out this whole thing called life. I learned how they overcome adversity and pick themselves up when they've been knocked down. Now, I'm sharing those discussions with you so you can apply those same learnings to your life. Welcome to It's Not a Straight Line.
All right, today on It's Not a Straight Line, I'm joined by producer, writer, and business manager Clayton Peters. You're the longtime business manager of your brother, comedy icon Russell Peters. I read that you were born in India. You moved to Toronto at a very early age, and then you spent a lot of your years in Brampton.
We did. Just to clarify off the top, I don't go by business manager, just manager.
Manager?
Yeah, a business manager is a separate function altogether. The business manager looks after all the accounting and all the money that comes through. But the manager oversees the entire scope of the business. But a business manager is a separate thing altogether. Just wanted to clarify.
Oh, that's great. Yeah. And one of my early questions to you was, can you explain, because I've worked in sport, I've worked a little bit in comedy, and they have different meanings for manager, agent, business manager. Explain your role for Russell and the difference between that, you just mentioned business manager, and why he needs an agent as well.
Being a business manager is like being the chief operating officer. So I keep all areas of the business going, and I keep them moving forward, versus an agent who will negotiate the deals for you. So in that capacity, what I do is I basically run the business on behalf of my brother. My brother and I'll have various conversations. We've got it down to minimal conversations, actually, in terms of how we run the business. So what I mean by that when I say minimal conversation is, it's like, when do you want to launch the new tour? What do you want to do? What are we going to call it? And when do you think you're going to be ready? Now, that's not something I'm pushing for. That's something I know through soft skills of knowing what his situation is. So we just wrapped a tour earlier this year, and we're launching a new tour in the fall. So what does that mean? That means, like, he'll say, well, you know, I need to be on the road. I need to go out there. I need to make money. And I said, okay. So then I'll get on the phone with the agents and I'll say, okay, we're ready to launch the new tour in the fall. Let's start putting it together. And they're like, do you want to hit the usual suspects? Yes, we want to hit, you know, the New York, Chicago, DC, Miami, Houston, all the big markets in the US. We want to go globally, which is what we've been doing now for almost 20 years, longer and bigger than anybody, not to toot our own horn. And what we will do is collectively, we will get our minds together and they will start reaching out to promoters. Okay. And they'll go to the promoters and say, Russell Peters is back on tour. Do you want to make an offer? And subsequently, they will start putting what we call routing together. Okay. They'll start getting avails from the promoters in the various cities and the various markets. And then we start doing sort of blocks of touring, right? So we'll do a whole bunch of US dates. But then, for example, I've already got plans for, you know, we're in the month of August now when we're recording this, but I've already got our plans to go to Australia, New Zealand in March of next year. And from there, we will then go to Asia off of that same routing. So there's a fair amount of logistics involved, but the agents are very competent. They know these markets and they know how it works and they know how we like to do it as well. So what they'll do is they'll, you know, like I said, they will get us the avails and they'll get us a routing, which is not an easy thing to do because what's happened with the business, not just the comedy business, but the entertainment business or live entertainment business in general, is that there's not a lot of money in sort of, there's no more DVDs, there's no more CDs. Yeah. So musical acts which used to generate a lot of income from those streams, are getting pennies on the play from Spotify, right? And pennies from Apple, right? And so that revenue stream is gone. So the only real way for them to make money is through licensing, meaning their song ends up in a movie or a commercial, or they're going on live tours, right? Because that's where the money is. So that's what we're competing against when they're getting a routing together. In some cases, we've been going through Asia, and then playing in behind us are K-pop bands, right? So you've got like, I think they're like BTS or something like that, right? So they're like, oh, BTS is on tour at that time too. So the venues are all booked up, or you can't go, or we're running just behind them or just ahead of them. Or somebody like Pink, who does massive global touring, is also, you know, you're running neck and neck, and you're fighting for venues, or it's little things like that that they're working through. So you can get a proper routing put together.
Yeah, and the promoters, if you're talking about North American promoters, you talk about the Live Nations of the world, the Just for Laughs of the world, and the AEGs of the world, for example.
Yeah, those are the big ones. Just for Laughs, not so much anymore, right, unfortunately. Yeah.
Comedy Ha, is it now? Or?
No, yeah, I'm not even sure what their new moniker is. I'm not that deeply involved in what's happening with them. But yeah, they've completely changed over. But yeah, there are Live Nation, AEG. But there are a lot of regional and smaller promoters, and we have preferences that we work with. I'll be honest, we do business with Live Nation in various markets, and some of those are because they own the building, okay? So if they own the building, a lot of times they'll make the offer directly, as we say, from the building itself. And in some countries, they have other promoters that they bought, so we deal with them there. But, you know, with Live Nation, we started dealing with them when we first started, when Jeff Wills was building out the comedy part of their business, back in 2007. And then we kind of drifted away from them a bit once they bought Ticketmaster. And that was my own sort of personal pet peeve, my own beef with them, if you will, because not only were they acquiring the buildings, but now they had the ticketing as well. And I just felt it was gross. It was greedy. It was gross. And I didn't like it. And I made it clear as much. I'm like, this is just, you're charging us for the building. You're getting money on the concessions, which we don't see. And now you're surcharging on the tickets and getting that revenue as well, plus building up those databases. And I just thought it was really, really gross in terms of just having your tentacles and everything. From a business perspective, if I was to step back and I was Live Nation, I'd be like, no, what we're doing makes perfect sense. We've got all of it, right? But I guess my sort of working class, leftist, Canadian, democratic, socialist mentality, I just couldn't get my head around it. And it really bothered me, that monopoly. So we kind of drifted away from them a little bit. But yeah, so there are many promoters. One of our preferred in the States is Outback out of Nashville, Tennessee. And then we have families that we deal with, like in Australia, we deal with the Bohm family, who were the first ones to take a chance on us in Australia. And then we have people that we deal with who sometimes flutter between some of these companies, but we'll maybe go with the person. You know, they were at AEG, now they're at Live Nation. Okay, we'll still deal with them because we know we can trust them, type of thing.
Yeah, and I know in your world, it would be a lot about trust, right? And even between your brother and you, it's a lot about trust.
Absolutely. You know, you hear stories like the Dane Cook story, for example, of his half-brother who had stolen millions of dollars from him. And people often bring that up to us. We just did something a couple of weeks ago where they said, you know, is your brother like Dane Cook's brother? And, well, I'm not, obviously. But one of the things that we've done is, you know, comes back to that business manager thing we talked about at the beginning, is we separate all the finances away from the two of us.
Oh, do you?
Okay. Yeah. So I'll negotiate the deals. I'll work with the promoters. I'll work with the agents. So I know exactly what the revenue is. I know what the back end will be and everything like that. But none of that money comes through me. It goes from the agents to the business manager, and then the commissions are paid and et cetera, et cetera. But that's a very conscious thing on my part too, because we also wanted to be very careful about taxes and things like that. Yes. To make sure that's all being allocated and paid on a global basis. It's quite tricky because we're paying, you know, let's say 25% withholding tax in India, right? Or in Australia. And all of that has to be accounted for when they do my brother's taxes at the end of the year. It's all quite, you know, there's a lot of minutia there, but so I've always kept the finance separate from us. And also
super smart.
Well, I don't know if it's smart or if it's good for my mental health, because
Well, I think both, right? You hear all these stories about even athletes that end up with an agent or manager, and then mm-hmm. they're even given improper financial advice early on, right? And many people don't have a career like the two of you have had, you know?
We've been very lucky. We've been very, very lucky. But, you know, coming back to the financial part of things, my brother can make me crazy with his spending.
Yes.
Right?
I've heard about
it. Yeah, he's very generous, exceedingly generous, too generous for his own good. It makes me nuts. So that was an early decision to say, when some of his ne'er-do-well friends are hitting him up for $10,000 on a regular basis, or my mortgage needs to be paid off, or, you know, I need this, or whatever, I need a new car, I mentally could not get my head around the fact that grown-ass men were, number one, asking for these things, and number two, he was giving it to them, okay? So I had to make a conscious decision to say, you know what, I have to treat him, even though he's my little brother, and I've been holding his hand from day one of his life, not this business even, but I have to separate myself from that, and I have to treat him like I've got a stable of 20 clients, and he just happens to be one of them, and the client's going to tell you whether they want to work or don't want to work, or what they want to do, and my job is to make the money. So that's what I do, okay? I make sure that he's making money, but that's where it ends. What he does with that money afterwards, I can't control, and as a big brother, he's making me nuts with it. You know what I mean? Like, I want him to have money, but I have to stand back and go, all right, man. And I know I'm the voice in his head, because I'll get those calls, you know, sort of 2 weeks later, I'll get a call saying, oh, you know, I bought this car.
Yeah.
Or I didn't tell you, but I got this new Rolex. I'm like, so I know that somewhere in the back of his head, I'm the voice that's like, the fuck are you doing right now? Excuse me if I'm swearing. I don't know if you swear.
No, you
but
can
yeah,
swear.
Yeah. I'm like, sure. I'm like, I know I'm the voice in his head.
Yeah.
Right. So, but on that basis, I still have to hang back, because every time, if he called me every time he was about to do it, I'd be like, don't do that, man. Like, you want to be MC Hammer? Like, just stop. Right. But I had to make a conscious, because it does affect me psychologically, to know that, you know, he's either not doing things wisely or whatever. So I have to completely detach myself from that part of his persona.
How's that journey been for you, Clayton, from the early days of having him spend to where you are now, for you personally? And what do you do to kind of balance that so you don't let it eat you up?
Some nights it'll, you know, I can wake up in the middle of the night and think about it and it'll make me nuts. But early days, the biggest challenge for when we started working together was when all this kicked off in 2005. The biggest challenge that we faced was we knew how to be brothers. We actually lived in our own townhouse, not unlike where we are right now. We'd been close our entire lives and we knew how to be brothers, but we didn't know how to be sort of manager and client or business partners. And that was one of the hardest things for us to figure out. And so we would have conflict. We would have a butting of heads. And also, when that first wave of success came, psychologically for him, it was very, very difficult. One would think that suddenly you're making millions of dollars and that your life is, this is amazing, right? I'm making all this money. This is fantastic. But I mean, most of us aren't prepared for a change like that. Right. If we go from being regular working class blue collar kind of guys, I wasn't blue collar, I was white collar. But if you just go from being like a regular guy making a regular salary, or you come from an immigrant home where, you know, your parents both worked and you guys did OK, you weren't rich, you weren't poor, you were just right there. And all your friends are basically just working class people. And suddenly you're catapulted from, you know, X number of dollars a year to having several million coming at you, and then people start treating you differently. And that was one of the things that happened with him, is that we went from 0 to 60, and all of a sudden people just started treating him differently, and he couldn't quite get his head around it, and it really bothered him. You know, friends started treating him differently, friends started asking for money, some friends were cool with it, some people were jealous of it, some family members were weird about it. Some people would say like, oh, you know, I'm not going to treat you guys any differently now. Like, well, no one asked you to. We're still the same guys. So there was a lot of stuff that comes at you when you suddenly go from nothing to something. And none of us is really prepared for that. And that was a challenge for him. Because I remember, you know, in just within those first 12 months, him going, you know what, fuck this. I'm just going to go back to playing clubs. right? Because everything got so weird and there's so much pressure and there's so many eyeballs on him and the media was on him. And he said, I'm just going to go back to playing Cubs. Like, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. This is what it is now. We have to deal with it. We have to figure out what we're going to do and how we're going to chart this path forward. So that was really, really tough at the beginning, which people don't expect.
And I think it's incredible how you would have had to navigate that and even how you would have reacted around family. And I wanted to go to something I heard you say one time when you wanted to start selling out arenas. People are like, no Canadian comic has done that before.
That's right.
Kind of. What was the discussion or what was the thing you and your brother were talking about at that time that made you say, let's just give it a shot?
Well, we had had some success under our belt touring Canada without a national name promoter behind us. And when we started, we were told by everyone, including Just for Laughs, who said, well, no, you're not going to be successful without us because we're a bigger brand than Russell Peters. So, you know, you need...
What year is this?
05,
okay.
06.
Okay.
Because Em and I started working together full-time in 2005. So we're coming up on 20 years together. And they said, no, you can't. You need us to do this to be successful. And I said, no, I don't think we do. I think we can do this. And so we launched our first tour independently. And my brother had a manager he worked with at the time named Ed Smeal, who used to work with Yuck Yucks. And Ed knew a gentleman named Harold Levin who ran the Yuck Yucks franchise in Ottawa. And he said, you should meet Harold. Harold has done some touring. He worked with CPI, which then eventually went on to become Live Nation. He was their Ottawa guy. And they said, you know, you should meet Harold. And Harold was a complete mensch. He was the one who backed us and took us across the country. And no one else would take a chance on us. No one else, an Indian comic, yeah, okay, sure, whatever. And no one had done that before. Yeah, he was a promoter. And as I said, he bankrolled us and he supported us. And he believed in us. And he became our guy for Canada. And we're still friends with Harold. We're still in touch with him. He did our previous Canadian tour. We made a small change up over the last couple of years, but nothing to do with Harold per se. But Harold was the guy who just looked after us and took a chance on us. And we always appreciated that. And we still love him and respect him to this day. I'm still in touch with him, with his family, with his daughter. Yeah, he was the guy who really was there with us and traveling with us and at the hotels with us and at the venues with us and watched us go from playing, you know, small theaters to going to do the arenas that we very quickly moved on to. And so when my brother kind of said, you know, well, I want to do Air Canada Center, I was a little bit skeptical, I have to admit, because that seemed like a big leap, right?
Because what were you leaping from? How many seats?
We were leaping from what had we done prior to that? I think we'd done like the North York Performing Arts Center.
So we talked in 2,000-seater?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of what we did before we did Air Canada Center. I think we just sort of made a leap.
And at this point, were there any HBO specials? What type of specials were back then? It wasn't Netflix.
I think there was no Netflix. It was, we had done something for, I didn't even know if that first special had aired yet on Comedy Central.
Okay.
Comedy Central and then Showtime and things like that. So forgive me for not knowing the exact sequence of events that led up to it. But when we did the Air Canada Center, I mean, that was a big deal. And like I said, I was skeptical about it. And then we first put the first show on sale. It sold out in a day. And then we rolled into a second show.
What's the feeling? You're 6 years older than your brother. You know, I've heard about how, you know, and we'll get into what your father and mother had told you, especially your dad about your brother. But you're walking into the Air Canada Center. It's sold out and your brother's performing and you're the manager behind it. What does that feel like for a first time?
It's quite surreal. The funny thing about playing the local Toronto shows or any of the shows that we've done at ACC, Scotiabank, is that it's like what I could say is it's the best day of the year and the worst day of the year. Okay, so what that means is like it's extremely stressful. It's hometown, you know, I'm hoping that he's going to be the best possible version of himself. We're hoping that the audience is going to be the best possible version of themselves. And then you've got this other thing, which is the incredible number of people that we know across the GTA that we've grown up with and all of the friends that he has, because he's very gregarious. He's got a lot of friends, you know, from Pickering all the way, you know, to Hamilton, and all of those people are hitting you up for tickets. Now, For me...
Now, are they going to him or are they coming to you a lot of the time?
It's a combination, because they know if they come to me, it's not always going to be a great answer for them. So they go to him because he's a softer touch, and they all know it, right? I don't know. I don't think they all sort of have a great love or affection for me, but they know my brother's a soft touch. So, you know, so we're doing, you know, 16,000 seats, but of which we're giving away 250 seats to friends and family. And I'll be honest, all I see are dollar signs above their heads, right? Those are all dollars that are not coming to us. And what pisses me off is that if we were in the diamond business, are they going to come and ask us for free diamonds? Or if we're in the restaurant business, are they coming and asking for free food? But no, this is our business. And the biggest misinterpretation that I see from outside is because I'm in a rather dour demeanor at these shows because I'm working. I'm seeing a lot of people who aren't paying, who are hanging around, who are eating our food. I'm just like, the fuck, man. Like, this is our work, right? And they're like, what's the matter with you? Why do you, what's wrong with you? Just relax. I'm like, how can I, this is our work. To the outside, you're coming to a show, a comedy show. Everyone's happy. Everyone's excited to be there. And they see it as like a party, right? And a lot of these people are from Caribbean backgrounds or Indian backgrounds or whatever background. And a lot of them like to go to clubs and party and they grew up like that. I grew up going to clubs, but they see it as this fun event that they're going to, right? And I get that.
And you're working.
I'm working.
You're working.
Okay.
So is your brother.
This is work for me, okay? This isn't, hey man, let's hang out, let's talk. It's like, no, I am working. This is what we do. And like, what's wrong with this guy? Like, why does he look so miserable? I'm like, because this is our work. To the outside, it's a party. To me, it's work. And so that's the challenge of doing the big hometown show. And it's still a challenge for me. Because I'm still not relaxed. It's very, very stressful. And also, you know, when you have that many guests, what happens is part of the Anglo-Indian mentality is being a good host, right? And it's not just Anglo-Indian. It's Indian. It's Middle Eastern. There's a lot of cultures that believe in being a good host. You are my guest. Are you okay? Can I get you something, right? Do you want something to eat? Do you want a drink? So now you've got all of these guestless people. And now you've got to make sure that after the show... Now they're all streaming backstage, right?
Well, and then they want to know what club you're going to.
They want to know this. They want, you know, they're hanging out. Are they drinking? They're eating. It's like, and then you've got the other people who are like legit guests who are, I don't know, media or people who've bought post-show passes or VIP meet and greets and things like that. And you have to deal with them as well. What happens is there's some people who are going to get dealt with very well. And then there's some people who are going to get sidelined or some people are going to have to wait 2 hours to meet my brother because he's got 150 people, friends and family in a room that he wants to talk to before he gets to these people. So I find it all quite stressful making sure that everybody's taken care of.
Clayton, I want to take it back here. You know, this podcast is called It's Not a Straight Line. And I really believe that we get put so much pressure on us in university and college or end of high school to be like, what are you going to do? And you're sitting here as who you are today, but you had a corporate career in oil and gas. What did you dream of becoming, say, when you were in university or college or high school? What did you want to do?
Well, that's interesting. So this is where it gets weird for me. I was telling you before the podcast, it's weird for me to talk about myself.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to do it, but it's, and I've been doing quite a few podcasts over the last few years and things. And I'm still sort of coming to terms with talking about myself because my business is not about me. It's about my brother, right? So all of a sudden you're saying, well, okay, tell us about you. And you're like, well, that's weird.
Well, and it's very interesting you say that because I do, early in my career, I wanted to be an athlete agent. And I've had the privilege to work with some athletes on endorsement deals. And so I still listen to them on podcasts. And I was listening to Rich Paul and then Jill Smolin, who's the... agent for Serena Williams, longtime agent. They hardly do many podcasts and they're starting to now, or they're starting to talk about themselves, but they all say their business is to serve their client.
That's right.
It's not about them.
Yes.
And do you think that's something, as you know, other managers or agents, that is a similarity that runs?
Absolutely. This whole business is not about you as an individual. It's about servicing the client and fulfilling their dreams and ambitions and creative ambitions and financial ambitions and goals. So when somebody says, okay, tell us about yourself, it's like, me? It's nothing. Nothing
no,
is
so
about me.
About
yeah,
you right now. So what the hell do you want to do?
Well,
or what do you still want to do?
Well, I'm going to be 60 in about 60 days. So
you look great.
Yeah, thanks. But it's weird to be turning 60. So to talk about what you want to do as you're coming up on 60 is a bit of a, it's a whole other existential crisis. I'll lie down on the couch. We could talk about that afterwards. But when I was younger, in my teens, I wanted to actually go into radio. Yeah, I wanted to do radio. I was obsessed with radio. As we were, it's a combination of factors on that one, because as once I discovered music and I started listening to the radio, it became an escape for me, right? Music became an escape. And then the radio and the radio announcers. And then you get to an age where you're kind of staying up late. And I had a little clock radio in my bedroom and I would kind of play up and down the dial. And later at night, you pick up signals from like Cleveland and all these kind of strange places and very faint signals, but I would still listen. And I had a very romantic idea of what radio was. And it was sort of somewhere between that WKRP and Cincinnati type scenario. So even now when I hear, and I don't listen to local radio at all, but every now and then you'll hear something, you'll hear a DJ talking and they're playing a song. And I still have that vision of a very darkened studio where he's got the big turntable, the big heavy turntable. He's putting the needle on, he's putting the arm on the record. He's having a cigarette in the background. So that was my sort of romantic idea of what radio was. And I wanted to do that, but my dad discouraged me from doing it because he wanted to be a journalist. And he had a very, very bad experience when he was going to pursue journalism. I've told this story before in that he had studied at Conestoga College in Waterloo and done journalism. And he had a portfolio and his professor sent his portfolio off to the Hamilton Spectator. And they looked at it and they said, oh, this guy's pretty good. You know, we'd like to have him. You know, we have a position. Can you send him over? And so it was Eric Peters, right? So they saw this anglicized white name or English name, whatever you want to call it. And my dad was a short, dark man. And, decidedly he was Indian. And when I say that, what I mean is I know that I can be ethnically ambiguous depending on where I am. People don't quite do the math on what I am or who I am. And same with our mom, who's very fair-skinned. So he's decidedly Indian and he gets in there, but he spoke perfect English. He spoke with a British accent. He was very, very proper in the way that he spoke and conducted himself in the way he dressed and presented himself, which kind of then rubbed off on my brother and myself. So when he got in there, he sent him Eric Peters for an interview. The receptionist kind of looked a little bit, okay, just a moment, please. Went in the back, came back out, and then some guy kind of peeked around the corner, and then she came back, and she's like, I'm sorry, the position's been filled. They sort of took one look at him and said, yeah, no, we can't have that in here. That's before diversity. That's before anything. You know, this is in the very early 70s, okay? And he never recovered from that. Emotionally, he never recovered from that. And he never went back to pursue it because it was too painful for him. And he had a young family. They'd been in the country less than 10 years at that point. And he had to do what he had to do to look after his family. So he took a job as a meat inspector. It was a union job. It was with the federal government. It had benefits. It had all the stuff that goes along with that. And he sucked it up, and that's what he did. He hated it. He hated every day of it, standing in 2-3 inches of blood and animal guts and the smell and all of it. He hated it. You know, getting up at 6 in the morning, 5:30 in the morning to go to this, you know, quite cold, you know, meat packing plant, Canada Packers over on Dundas, and then eventually moving to Brampton to go work at Pinecrest Foods, which was all chickens. But he never wanted my brother and myself to experience that kind of disappointment or that kind of pain. So as a result of which, he kind of kept our ambitions modest, okay? Sort of shoot for the middle, okay? So, you know, a lot of Indians and you know, your wife is Anglo-Indian, so you know what I'm talking about. When it comes to sort of Indians, it's now in 2024 and over the last 20 years, doctors, lawyers, engineers, accountants, dentists, you know, reach for the stars, right? But for Anglo-Indians in general, we were kind of this sort of blue-collar, working-class kind of a people, and we still are. Even though we're a community in decline, we're going to be extinct within the next 50 years, I'm sure. So they kept the ambitions modest for us. And my dad specifically kept it modest because he didn't want me to experience that. So when I told him I wanted to go into radio, his thing was, look, you know, that's not for us. That's for them. Okay. You're going to have to start in some small town somewhere, Northern Ontario or Northern Alberta or somewhere small, because you're not just going to get a job at Chum FM right? Or what CHFI or whatever the big radio station in Toronto is.
They still got the chum sign.
Yeah, right? They still have it. That was the big thing, right? But you're not going to start there. You're going to have to go out to middle of nowhere and do these gigs. And he says, listen, in some of those small towns, they're not that friendly to people like us or who look like us. And he didn't want me to experience that. And so he just said, you know, that's great and all, but let's just maybe get a union job or a government job and just do that instead. So that's what I wanted to do. And at one point, I wanted to be an archaeologist or an anthropologist or something like that. I remember that. I was quite keen on both of those things in my childhood. But it was radio that I wanted to go into. And then...
You do have a great radio voice, like a great voice for this.
My voice sounds fat.
Oh, but it sounds really good.
To me, when I hear my voice, it's like, man, that guy's voice is fat. He's a fat guy voice. It's just, makes me nuts. I can't stand it.
What did you do in oil and gas in corporate? Were you in like finance?
No, I was international contracts manager. I ended up going into logistics and international business is what I ended up going into. Just through various things. I was in high school, first part of high school, maybe not that great, but the latter part, I was doing victory laps because I didn't know what I wanted to do. But I was fairly popular and I'd made a lot of friends. And then I came out of high school and I didn't want to go to university. Because university, which was, and this is stupid on my part, this is just dumb. Like, I didn't want to go because, like, 4 years. Oh my God, wait, 4 years. You know, when
such
you're young.
A long time.
Long time. Meanwhile, all my friends had gone off to university. So I was just this idiot who was like, yeah, no, I'm not doing that. I'm going to do something else, right? And then I was just working in retail, right? I worked at Le Chateau and Aldo and then all these other part-time jobs and things like that. And my dad's like, you know, you don't want to be like, you know, 50 years old and working at the mall till 9:30 at night, closing the store when your family's at home. You know, you've got to do something more than that. And I was living at home and they were cool. I was paying rent and they were fine with it, but my dad definitely wanted me to kind of, okay, you know what, we got to figure something out here. So I got a job at the airport with a customs broker delivering advice notes. I had no idea what I was doing, but I was at the airport. I was driving a car. I was getting paid. I was like, all right, fine, whatever. And then a friend of mine who I was good friends with in high school, him and his father had a freight forwarding company. And he's like, what are you doing? I'm like, yeah, I'm working. He goes, well, why don't you come work with us? I'm like, okay. So I started working with them, with Andy and his dad. And Andy and I are still friends to this day. I worked with Andy and his dad in freight forwarding and then another family friend. And I learned that business. I learned logistics and transport and international and how those things worked. Advice notes, customs releases, all of that stuff. Freight, LCL, full containers. It was fun. We were these two young guys, 21 years old, you know, we were wearing suits to work. It was the 80s. Everyone wanted to work in an office and wear suits and drive BMWs. It was very sort of like, hey, man, this is pretty cool. And then another friend of ours had a plastics and chemicals business. And he says, well, what are you doing there? And I did some business for him. And he's like, well, why don't you come work with me? I'm like, okay, right. So I went there. I worked in plastics and chemicals. I did that for actually quite a few years and set up a distribution center for him in Florida. Had a falling out, got fired, and then Andy and his dad resurfaced again, and they had moved on to a bigger business, and they were living in Germany. And they said, listen, we're starting a freight forwarding company here in Toronto. We need somebody to run it, da-da-da-da. So I ran that company for them. They liked what I did, and then they're like, hey, why don't you come over to Germany and do some stuff with us here? I'm like, okay, cool, right? I was 28 years old. I'm like, yeah, sure, let's go to Germany. And I lived there for several years working with Andy and his dad. And it was the time of my life. It was, you know, other than sort of the, shall we call it the high life or the cool stuff I get to do now, that was kind of the coolest period. I was living in Germany. I was traveling to Russia, North Africa, China, tooling around Europe, Czech Republic, going to Paris, Amsterdam. We'd go there for the weekend, go to Switzerland. It was, you know, when you're in your 20s and you're, you know, you're a young guy living out in the world, I had a good time. Like it was fun. And eventually that ended. They, you know, their business changed. And then like I came back to Canada. And then I kind of had to sort of rebuild my life a little bit when I came back because I was kind of at loose ends and I wanted to start another business. I wanted to start when I was in Germany. I couldn't get decent chips, right? I couldn't get decent chips. I was always bringing like bags of potato chips back with me when I'd come home at Christmas or come home for holidays and stuff. I'm like, they need chips over here. So I tried to start that business, but I couldn't get the bridge financing. So I just took a regular job as an export manager with an automotive company. And then from there, I was coming into my late 30s. So I was about 37, 38 years old. And I've always had a weird obsession with age and time in terms of what am I doing? Like what's on the horizon? right? And that was the same thing that happened in my early 20s. Like, even with my dad sort of pushing me a little bit, I'm like, yeah, I'm 21. I need to get this figured out. And my friends were, some friends had already like gotten married and had kids, which was really weird. And then other friends had just come out of university and they were starting their careers, or they were doing their post, you know, their after, you know, they were getting their next degree or whatever. And I was this guy who was just kind of floundering. So when I was 37, coming up on 38, I started to sort of fixate on the fact I was going to be turning 40. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to be 40. I haven't done anything. I'm not doing enough. I need to make more money. And the owner of the company I was working for, he was getting on in years. And I'm like, you know, what happens when he sells or he retires? What's going to happen to me? So I got this other job in oil and gas.
And I think this is a key point right here, because you're 37, 38, you're still thinking, hey, I got to get this going. And beyond that, you had this incredible career now with your brother, right? Like so
later.
But so many people are like, oh shit, I'm 35. I have no clue what I'm doing, or I don't like this job or whatever.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And the funny thing about all of those years in corporate was that I was always a square peg in a round hole. Okay. I was always a bit of a misfit. I knew how to wear a suit. I knew how to dress. But it was always kind of, it was a bit clunky for me. It was never like really smooth. I didn't like coming into work early. I didn't like coming into work on time. I didn't see the point. It was like 8:30. If I get here 8:30 or 9 o'clock, what difference does it make? Because I didn't care about working late. It wasn't like at 5 o'clock, I'm like, I'm out, right? I would work till 6, 7, 8 o'clock. I was single. Right? It didn't matter to me when I left the office. I just didn't want to be like killing myself to get there for 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning. Always a problem. My entire work career, every company, there was that meeting with the guy who was my boss, who would say, Peters, you know, what's the matter with you? What's your problem? Why can't you get here the same time as everybody else? Everyone else is here on time. What's so special about you? And I said, well, look, man, you know, I'm going to work. Everyone's gone home right at 5. They're out of here. I'll be here till 6:30, 7, 8, 9 o'clock at night. I don't care. I just don't need that morning thing, right? He's like, well, everyone else does it. You have to do it. And it was a constant battle everywhere I went. Every time they would give me a new manager, he's like, I'd be the first guy they'd come batting for. But he's like, we're gonna whip that Peters guy into shape. I'm gonna get him here on time. You watch. Leave it with me, Bernie. I got this, you know. And that would be the battle, and it would be on. And I would fight these guys all the time. Like I'd be like, I'm like, no, man, I'm not doing it. And it was a bit of a precursor to where we are now in terms of the workday, because now we have a work system where people work from home. They have flex time. They come into the office maybe 2 or 3 days a week. They're on their laptops all the time. And that was early days of getting laptops and dial-up and stuff like that. And because my work was international, I was corresponding with Indonesia in the middle of the night. You know, I was corresponding with this other country. So I was kind of like, look, I get home and I'm still working with a lot of our partners and things like that. Everything's fine. It's still working. If I'm here at 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning or 10 o'clock in the morning even, it doesn't make a lick of difference, because my work is not contingent on the people around me. My work is contingent on their international stuff. It was always international business for me. But again, the mentality was so drilled into people's heads that, you know, you get up, you come to the office, you're here at this time. It was very conformist, and I was always a nonconformist. And I was always battling with these people. And even in that first job, you know, they were shipping to South Africa. And I'm like, I can't ship to South Africa. It's apartheid. I'm not going to do it. Right. And it was a conflict. Right. Well, look, you know, this is where you work and this is what you're going to do. Right. But, you know, I sort of had these sort of leftist socialist principles in my head drilled into me by my dad, you know, sort of principle stuff. But anyway, it was always a conflict for me when I was doing that 9 to 5. And then I got into oil and gas, and it was even more so because it was such a conservative business. And it was a very WASPy company that I worked for. And they just could not get their head around the fact that this brown guy was just like, I don't care. Right.
And being that nonconformist and working with your brother, mm-hmm. who, you know, we know, you know, I know his type of comedy. Mm-hmm. I read an article, I think it was in Variety, of Vince Vaughn recently saying that, you know, the raunchy R-rated comedies are, you know, no one wants to take a risk on it because they can keep their job if they don't take a risk on things.
That's
like
right.
That. And you've seen the Tom Brady roast, you mm-hmm. know, your brother's type of comedy. You even see Snoop Dogg now in the Olympics, and everyone thought that was the best thing ever, right?
Sure.
And he was a rapper where someone was like, hey, Mom, you want to watch Snoop Dogg? You grounded me for listening to
That's
his
right.
album.
Yep. Yeah.
Where do you think comedy and some of these sensitivities around it might go in the next 10 years?
Well, I think we're coming out of the whole cancel culture thing. I think that the Tom Brady roast definitely represented a switch in mentality of people getting offended or saying the wrong or being afraid of saying the wrong things because it was so well received and it was really damn funny.
It was so funny.
And all those R-rated comedies from the early 2000s into the mid-teens that we watched, the Judd Apatow stuff, was all fantastic.
Yes.
Right? From, you know, 40-Year-Old Virgin to Superbad to all of it, you know, it was that was a really solid period of time for R-rated comedies. Ron Burgundy, I mean, there was some old school, there was just so much and it was all so good. Vince Vaughn was a big part of all of them for the most part. So I think we're going to come back to that. But when you talk about people keeping their jobs and people being conservative in their employment, that's a lot of the problem that you have in Hollywood. It's a big problem here in Canada too, in terms of the entertainment business. You know, you're dealing with the executives. You know, I'll give you an example. We were at NBC with a development deal.
Okay.
And we were working on this show and we had a writer. And so we had all these network executives, all of whom I quite liked, actually. They were really nice. They were very cool. So we were dealing with them and it was about a guy. It was my brother's character. He lived in the Valley. He had, I think he was a single dad or something like that, but he was a writer. And then, you know, you go into these meetings with the executives and they're like, we don't really like writers right now. We'd rather he was a lawyer. And then somebody else at the table is like, I don't like the name Bill. Can we call him Dave? I don't like the idea that he has a son. Can we make it a daughter? So you've got all these voices. Now, we had gone through a few development cycles. So I'm like, you know what? I guess we've really got to learn how to play with these people. We're not playing nicely with any of these people. We need to conform a little bit. We need to kind of go along to get along because we've not been successful so far. And same with my producing partner
in
LA.
How does that make you feel as someone who always liked to push the envelope, it sounds like?
Well, you know, you're kind of getting bashed around a little bit because you're like, you keep going through these development things. And these development, to develop a TV show, it's 18 to 24 months.
Wow.
Minimum.
Wow.
With lots of meetings, lots of conference calls, lots of dinners and lunches, a lot of, not a lot of bumping of heads, but a lot of like, you know, as I say, you get into you get a lot of consensus building.
Yes.
Okay. A lot of people who their job, if they don't say something, then they're technically not doing their job. So they'll just throw something out. Like, I don't think it should be a boy. I think it should be a girl.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Just to be heard.
Just to be heard and to justify their position, their seat at the table, basically. Whether it makes sense or not, it's like, yeah, that was me. I did that. Yeah. Right. So it's a lot of conformity. So at this stage, I'm like, okay, let's just go along. All right. So we'll do this. We'll make all the changes and we'll give them the script and we'll get a go show at NBC. Regime change comes in. Yeah. Regime change meaning so-and-so's out, Ben Silverman's out as head of comedy, and, you know, this other guy's in. You go, Jennifer Salk who came in, and she's like, you know, we don't love this show. We don't, like, and the whole team that you dealt with is now gone.
Gone, yeah.
Gone.
Window.
Right? And they're like, we don't really love the show. We don't like this. We don't like that he's a lawyer. We prefer he's a writer. We don't like he has a boy. We should have a girl. So all the stuff that her people or the previous regime had sort of imparted to us, like you should do this, this, and this, has now completely flipped on its head. So it kind of shows you how arbitrary all of this stuff is. And she's like, so we're not going to go ahead with the show. So you're like, oh, so we did all of that for nothing. And that's what happened. So you talk about people being afraid. Everyone in Hollywood's afraid of losing their job.
Yeah.
It's a coveted place to be. It's a place that everyone wants to go to. It's a place that every, you know, even as far as like my brother goes, he's not much for being on time. He's not much for knowing his lines. He's not much for being necessarily prepared for some of these opportunities. And those are the kind of the basic rules is be on time and know your mark, right? Know your lines and know your mark when you get to the set. And so they're quite, it's ruthless, but it's ruthless from a fairly pragmatic position in that you don't want to do it. You don't want to conform to how we do things. Okay. Next. Because outside that door is a lineup of guys who looks a little bit like you, as either better looking or better educated or Juilliard trained or wants it more than you do. So you're like, okay, we'll see you later. Open the door and there's a clone that'll come in. Better prepared, better equipped. Right? And if that guy doesn't work, next. There's no shortage of people to feed the machine. So they know that they can be quite, that people are quite disposable in that business. Same for the executives, right? It's the same thing. They come, they go, they come, they go.
And what about someone like you? You mentioned everyone's afraid to lose their job, and you have this interesting relationship. And I don't know if for, you know, a few minutes you can just talk about what it's like to work with a brother. And, you know, I'm sure at times throughout your long relationship, him or you might have been like, I want to go a different direction. Like, I want to do something else. Or he might have wanted to go a different direction. I'm not sure.
I've always maintained that if there was another manager that came along and, you know, hey, you know, your brother's not doing this and not doing that. And this kind of happened during COVID quite a bit. We drifted quite a ways apart during COVID because we weren't really working, which was problematic financially, of course, more so for him than for me. And I wasn't able to travel with him. So we weren't spending sort of time together every minimum 6, 8, 10 weeks, you know, where we'd be together for, you know, a long 3, 4 days together, just the two of us or with our, you know, with our the rest of the people who work with us. And so we really did a drift, continental drift that happened during COVID. And also, he was...
I was here,
he was there. My wife is immunocompromised, so I had to be very, very careful about traveling during that time.
Yes.
I couldn't take a chance of bringing COVID home with me. So I stayed home. And he was down there. And listen, he was... There were a lot of new people coming into his world, I found.
Yeah.
Okay, during that time.
Oh, I bet.
A lot of voices, a lot of people coming into his ear. And I watched it and I listened to it and I saw it unfolding, but there's very little I could do about it. I can't sort of go, I can't, you know, it's not a situation where I can be sort of defensive, like, no, listen to me, listen to me. It's just like, okay, is that what you're hearing? Is that what you're thinking? Is that what you're feeling? Okay. It's not like it's not that you're not going to fight for it, but at the same time, what is the fight that you're doing? It's like, I know what I've done. I've earned my bona fides. And if somebody else is going to come along, It's sort of like being, it's like any of us in a relationship or a marriage or a girlfriend or whatever. If somebody's going to come along and take your partner from you, hey man, all right. It's not that I don't want to be with that person. It's like, if that is going to happen, it's going to happen. And so during COVID, there were a lot of new voices and new people coming into the mix and new friends and people saying, oh, you should be doing this and you should be doing that. And him going, I should be doing that. I should have that. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, but you don't like to come on time. You don't like to do this. You don't like to read scripts. You don't, you know what I mean? Or you don't like to save the money to have the money for that investment. You should have that. Yes, you should have that investment. Yes, we should be doing this. And I've had people come to me over the years saying, you know what you guys should do? And I'm like, tell me. And there's nobody who's told me anything that I've never thought of before or that we've tried to execute before. There's no magic. There's no magic thing. But everyone on the sidelines is like, you know what you should do? I'm like, oh yeah. Well, I've already thought about it and I've already gone through it and I know the limitations of my client. Okay. That's important.
Yeah.
Right. I know what his limitations are and I know what we've tried to do with them and I've seen where it failed.
Yes.
So I know exactly what you're saying. Like we just did a thing a couple of weeks ago and he's like, I want to do a podcast again. You should do a podcast. Hey, Russell, you should do a podcast. You're so interesting. You know all this stuff. And I'm like, well, he had a podcast.
You had one with your mom in it.
Yeah. With times, on,
right?
on his.
Yeah.
But he wasn't into it.
Yeah.
It makes sense when you hear him on a podcast talking and he's like talking about all these, you know, boxing and entertainment and rap and hip hop and music. Like, man, this guy'd be great as a podcaster. But then push comes to shove and like, okay, we're going to do the podcast now. It's kind of, there's a dip. You know what I mean? Like he would be great at it if he was committed to doing it. And this isn't a slight against my brother. It's just understanding the strengths and weaknesses and the picadillos of an individual.
That's what you need to understand.
Yeah.
That's so important.
Yeah. It's like somebody saying to me, oh, Clayton, you're like a big guy. You should play football. I'm like, you know, like,
yeah.
I don't care about football. It's like, I'm not going to be good at it. It's like, you know, there's always people who's like, oh, you should do this. You should do that. But in this situation, I know what his strengths and weaknesses are. So again, coming back to that thing during COVID and conflict and things like that, where we kind of drifted apart and we've come back together, but, you know, I don't think we're as strong as we used to be. Right. And coming back to the point of like, if there was someone else to come along and say, I can do a better job. Or he's like, I want to go with this manager. I'm like, okay, you know what? If that's what you feel, if they...
How would that affect you in a personal relationship with your brother?
On a personal level, as a big brother who's wanted nothing but the best for his little brother,
yeah.
I would say, I want the best for you. So I love you. I want the best for you. And if you feel like this is the best thing for you, then by all means.
Yeah.
Okay? Like, I don't want to be the one to hold him back from something. I don't want to be the hindrance.
Of course.
It's like my pet peeve when we're on tour and we're checking out of a hotel. I don't want to be the last one in the lobby, okay, as the manager, right? We're 6, 7, 8, sometimes 10, 12 people, right? I never want to be the last guy in the lobby. I don't want to be the guy that holds everybody up. I don't want to be the cause for us being late for a plane or a car or a flight or whatever. I need to be there, right? In other words, if I'm holding you back from achieving a level of success that you think you can achieve with someone else, then by all means do that, because I want what's best for you.
That's amazing.
Right? Now, for me, I don't know. I've never thought, like, maybe that'll be better for me. Psychologically, maybe it'll be better for
And
me.
Have you ever, like, I know you've been a writer, producer. As a manager, and I know top managers like you, whether it's in entertainment or athletics, it seems like they only manage a small group of people, mm-hmm. whereas an agent can have many, many clients. Yes. You must be approached a fair bit. Say, hey, Clayton, can you manage me? Have you ever been managing a group of other clients?
Early days, I took on some other guys, friends of ours, and I did some managing of them, including Joe Coy, who's huge now.
Oh, yeah.
Right? But the fact is, my brother's stuff was coming at us so fast and so aggressively at that time that I couldn't properly service other clients. So I kind of had to let that go. Now, if I was smart, and this is probably one of the few regrets I have of our 20 years together, I would have built out a management company. And I would have built out something where I had other younger managers
yes.
who were looking after these guys, paying them, I don't know, $60,000, $75,000 a year
yep.
to look after a bunch of younger up-and-coming comics in the hopes that one or two or all of them were going to make it big, and then you'd sort of get your money back and make money on them. But I was so focused on looking after my brother and the business as it was coming to us that I just kind of let that slide. And that's probably the biggest regret I've had over this time period, was not building out a proper management company and just looking after my brother.
Could you ever do something like that now, or at this point in your career, would that not be
quite frankly, yeah, you know what? Quite frankly, I think I'm too old. And when I say that, it's not that I sort of lack the energy for it, but a lot of this business is at night.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I have a wife. I have an 11-year-old son. I would much rather be home with them than
yeah.
sitting in a comedy club,
yep.
you know, somewhere in the city at 10 o'clock on a Wednesday night or a Thursday night. I would rather have the work-balance life that I have now versus doing that. And also, you're not going to make a lot of money off of the guys that are around these days. You'll make some money, but relative to the amount of time and energy you have to put in, to me anyway, it's not worth it for me. And all of these guys have managers. Lots of management companies out there. There's a lot of managers here in Toronto that are doing well. They have a fairly big stable, so they're making sort of reasonable amounts off all of these artists.
Yeah.
And that's great. I don't begrudge them that. I'm happy for them.
Mm-hmm.
But it was never sort of my mindset or my goal. And I'm so as much as I regret not doing it, at the same time, you know, coming up at this age with my personal circumstances and things like that, it is what it is, and it's not going to change.
So I got to ask, you mentioned your 12-year-old son.
11.
Or 11, sorry. What's his name?
Matthew.
Matthew. So as a father now, how do you guide your son in maybe what he might want to pursue and in life versus how your father might have guided you and Russell?
Well, you know, the journey that my brother and I have been on is so far removed from anything we could have ever imagined. There is an element of anything is possible.
Yeah.
Okay. Because we have done things that by rights we had no business doing. We've been in rooms with people, kings, presidents, prime ministers, dinners, and places that were just like kind of going, the hell are we doing here? Like, how did this happen?
Yeah.
Right? We're two working class goofs from Brampton, right? You know, like, what are we doing here with Prince Charles? Like, what are we doing here with Mohammed bin Saud?
Unbelievable.
What are we doing with King Abdullah at the palace right now having teppanyaki in his basement? How did this happen? But what that tells me is that anything's possible. So I can instill that in my son. And my son is, interestingly, he's aware of what I do very intimately. He's aware of who his uncle is and what we have accomplished. And he's very proud of it because within 10 minutes of meeting most people, he always tells them who his uncle is.
Wow.
Okay. You know, my uncle is this, my uncle is Russell Peters, my brother, blah, blah, blah. So he's very proud of it and he gets it. He gets that it's a unique position that we have. It's a unique position that his uncle has. and we get to do a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's been on tour with us. He's come out on tour 2 years ago. I brought him on the first week of the Canadian tour. He just finished school. He likes flying. He's very comfortable on private jets. He's developed very expensive habits. He likes, he's 11. He likes oysters. He likes lobster. He likes steak. He likes sushi. He likes gyoza dumplings. He likes my mom's curry and rice. He likes butter chicken and naan. He's got a very enhanced palate, a fairly sophisticated palate in terms of what he likes. He knows how to conduct himself on a private jet. He knows how to conduct himself in business class. Created a bit of a monster, I'm afraid. But the way I see it is that I saw this with another friend of mine with his son. We've kind of created an environment or shown him a world of possibility.
Yeah.
Okay? If you study hard, now I didn't study hard. I got lucky. But if you study hard or you focus and you know what it is you want, you can get there. Look at what we have done. Look at what you've seen. So if you know that this world is out there, you can go for it. Growing up, we never had an idea that this world was even tangible for us. This is not something we're like, oh yeah, one day I'm going to do this, and one day I'm going to go to a private jet, one day I'm going to go to this palace, one day I'm going to do that. None of that was part of our mindset, but somehow we got there. So I saw, as I said, with another friend of mine, you know, he sent his son to skiing school, he went to school in Switzerland, you know, and his son traveled in business class, he had like good suits and everything. And this is like a regular guy, he'd done fairly well in business. I remember there was like pushback from his girlfriend or other people, and they're like, well, why should he fly like that? Why should he be wearing a Tom Ford suit? And he's like, just, you know, I want him to understand what is attainable in life, okay? And once you kind of have a little bit of a taste of that, you kind of want to get back there a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you want to go, oh yeah, I did that and I want to do that again. I like that.
Yeah.
Right? So in terms of guiding my son, the one thing I say is like anything is possible. And he wants to be a pilot.
Nice. Amazing.
He wants to be a pilot. He's obsessed with planes and airports and travel and he's very intrigued by the physical world, architecture and geography and things like that. So I'm hoping that, yeah, if he becomes a pilot, that's fantastic. He'll go out and see the world. And because I travel so much, he has that as being a normal thing, okay? It's a normal thing to go to Dubai. It's a normal thing to go to London.
Yes.
It's a normal thing to go to Paris or you know, to go to Tokyo or Bangkok or whatever. These are, oh yeah, my dad did that all the time. So yeah, that's normal. That's doable, right? So in terms of guiding my son, that's sort of what I'm trying to get into his mindset of anything is possible. Look at what we've done. Look at what you've seen. You can do this too. You just have to apply yourself, but it's not going to be given to you. That's the one thing that I do emphasize. Okay. There's no family business for me to hand down to you.
Yeah.
Okay. When I die, okay, there might be some money there.
Yeah.
But you're going to have to go out and make it on your own. Okay. You may get a little kickstart.
Yes.
But there's no hereditary thing coming your way where it's like, oh, I'll introduce you to so-and-so and then you'll go on and so forth. Or there's no big family business of uncles and aunts and everybody who's going to guide you. It's achievable. You'll get a little kickstart, but you're going to have to go out and make it on your own.
That's amazing. So as we come to the end of this, and I love that advice. Advice I've always had for myself was that there was this Adidas commercial and it said, you know, instead of saying nothing is impossible, it says impossible is nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And I just always remember that. You know, as we wrap this up, one, thank you. I have so much gratitude for you being here and just being, you know, on this podcast, so open, being humble for everything you've accomplished. So thank you very much, Clayton.
Thank you.
What are the things people should watch out for? Do you got any tours coming up that people should grab tickets to? I think there was involvement in Just Rain's show recently that you can check out.
Yeah, we executive produced Late Bloomer with Just Rain. We were lucky to be part of that. Just Rain, Jasmeet, is a hell of an artist. He's a great writer. He's a true artist on that show. So I have to be honest, we didn't do a lot on that because he had such a great vision. Now you talk about conformity in terms of, I'm sorry to sidetrack, but you talk about our experiences like in NBC and trying to take in all of the people's notes and all this kind of thing and incorporate it in the show. He was the opposite. He had a very clear vision of that show. When we first met him, when he came to my brother's house in Calabasas several years ago with his laptop, and he showed us his lookbook, basically. Here's what I want the show to look like. Here's what I want it to be about. Here's the colors. He knew the colors and the thematic. Like he knew all the music, the sound, everything about that show. He knew it in his head, which is far better than anything we'd ever done.
Yeah.
He's a true artist that way. And he knew the tone of the show. He knew what stories he wanted to tell. and he did it on his own terms. Like, that is his show. There was nothing for us to add to that show. He's an absolute genius that way. I've got to give him credit because it's a very, very good show.
Is he Brampton too? Is he from Brampton?
He's actually Guelph.
Guelph?
He's from Guelph of all places. Wow. Yeah, and a very interesting guy. But like I said, a true artist, a creative genius, a visionary, and I have to give him credit. And I have to be honest, like there was nothing really for us to contribute to that show because he knew what it was he wanted to do.
Yeah.
So again, coming back to that other story, there was no need for other voices to come in. There was no need for somebody to say, you know, your character's name should be this or this character should be that. He knew what it was he wanted to do and he fought those battles.
I love that.
He fought for it. So yeah, we executive produced that show for what it's worth. But we love that show and I'm very proud of the fact that I was able to be part of it in a very limited way. And same with my brother. I wish we could have done more, but honestly, you know what? When somebody's that good, you just kind of go, okay, you go, girl. Right?
That's amazing.
So we did that. My brother's new tour kicks off in the fall. It's called Relax. It's Not That Serious. That starts in the fall. We've got a couple of documentaries projects we're working on. We're actually working on a documentary about his life, a bio doc.
Oh, cool.
That is very current in terms of the discussions that we're having and trying to get all of that put together. It's been politically difficult to do that. Believe it or not, we've been turned down by every fund in the country.
Really?
Telefilm, Rogers, everybody. Every single fund turned us down for the development of this documentary, believe it or not. They literally turned us down. Some of them even said, well, he's Russell Peters, he has enough money. You know, you don't need our money. You don't need the government money to make it. That being said, as I said to our production partners, and I would say to these people as well, if you were to come along and say, I'm going to make a documentary on Drake, and Drake, who's got more money than God, and I don't fault him for it. I'm happy for his success. I'm happy for all that he's achieved. I respect his business, OVO, all of it. I really do. But if you were to go to them and say, we're going to make a documentary on Drake, they would throw millions of dollars at you. And like I said, Drake doesn't need the money.
So why did these companies say, like, hey, we're not going to take this on?
These are government institutions that have turned us down for the doc. And there's any number of reasons. Some say, oh, he doesn't need the money. Some, there have been some pushback from what the jokes he made at the Junos that various people took offense to. You see, the thing about my brother is this, and myself for that matter, is that we're not particularly woke.
Yeah. Okay?
So I'm a leftist, big social justice guy. I'm supporting all the sort of causes and things like that. But my brother's the same way, but he's not doing it on a public level. Okay. So there's a lot of artists out there who are like, oh, I support this and I support that and I do this and I do that and I believe in this and I believe in that. He keeps all that stuff to himself, okay?
Yeah.
So he's not out there sort of promoting the cause du jour, shall we say, whether it's at a certain point it was mental health that everyone was talking about or it was their sexual identity or it was something else. So he's not sort of in that world. And also the nature of his comedy is race, culture, sex. It can be crude, it can be crass, it can be basic. And again, a lot of the powers that be, especially at these elite institutions, these government institutions that are sort of governed by these sort of limousine liberals, if you will, where they're in their little Leaside cloisters and on the Danforth or wherever they are in the city, and they're all sort of speaking the same sort of wokest kind of thing, and he's not doing that. As I always say, he's not running for public office.
Yeah.
He's not asking you to like him. Okay, you don't like his comedy, don't support him. No problem. So now they've taken it, I think, to a level where it's like, well, we just, you know, he's talking about race and he's making fun of these people and those people. We're just not doing that anymore, right?
Yeah.
And so it's hard for them to get their head around it because it doesn't speak to their sort of social causes, or it's not an acceptable public facade for them. So I think there's pushback on that as well. Right? If he did something, like, it's easy to love a musician because they're singing about love and, you know, all these kind of things, but that's not what he's talking about. So I feel like there's a certain element within this very small elite community that controls these things. And they all bounce around from one institution to another. They make a shit ton of money off of our taxes, right? But they've decided, nah, not him.
Yeah.
Okay. And the one thing about my brother that I will say as well as part of this rant, if you want to call it that, is that he also is, he's very male. He's very much a guy.
Yeah.
Okay. He likes hip hop. He likes his R&B. He likes all the music.
Boxing, MMA.
Boxing, MMA, very male. And in some of those circles, I can't even stand it because they're so right wing. I'm like, fuck off already with the MMA stuff. But that's where he, that's what he likes. Okay. It's very male. And, you know, he likes women. He has been a womanizer in his past. He's just maybe a little bit too much of a masculine brown guy that they just don't want to put forward right now. The analogy that I give, and I'm not saying that he's at this level, was you could not have Denzel Washington in 1965, but you could have Sidney Poitier in 1965. Maybe slightly more elegant, not quite as sexually threatening as a Denzel, but still a good-looking guy, great actor, great charisma, great charm. But you couldn't have that sort of in-your-face kind of a black guy at that time.
Yeah.
So if you look at the Indian guys or South Asian guys that they're putting forward as being the sort of acceptable faces of the community right now, they're not overly masculine, if you want to put it that way. Okay, they're a little bit of fat, they're a little bit short, they're dark, they're whatever, but they're not exactly the most sort of exemplary examples of masculinity that you'd want to put forward right now. And he definitely, I think, is from that world. He's a little bit retro. He's a little bit of a, you know, rat pack sort of sentiment mentality, but he doesn't conform to what they want him to be. And nonconformity, well, that's our thing, man.
That's your thing. So you've got the tour come up. You said relax.
It's not that serious.
Yeah. It's a pretty cool cover picture of
that. Yeah, yeah. That came up with that over the last few months.
That's pretty sweet. Here, I've got three quick questions you can answer in a phrase or one word if you like to close it out. I call these the zigzag questions. It's not a straight line. What's one thing you hope, Clayton, that your son remembers about you in your career?
I don't really think about that often, other than dad kind of lived life on his terms.
Yeah.
Right? He did what he wanted to do, and he got to do some pretty cool stuff.
That's really about it. I know if you listen to Clayton in other interviews you've done, your dad seemed to live life on his terms, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, yes and no.
Other than the journalism thing. What learning have you seen in entertainment that you think just applies to life or anyone's career?
Don't take it personally.
Yeah.
That's the number one thing. Don't take it personally. Okay. If they reject you for an audition, it's not personal. Okay. As much as I'm ranting and raving about telephone and all those funds, which are a little bit personal. But, you know, a lot of it is just not personal. It's just there is a bit of a school of fish mentality within this business. I remember we were out with the Indian Detective at one point, and that was when True Detective came out on HBO. So everyone wanted a True Detective. They didn't want the Indian Detective to be a broadish comedy, and it wasn't really. It was fun. Some people love it, some people hate it. But what happens in this business is if something catches on, everyone's like, oh, we got to do it like that.
Yeah.
Right? Oh, what's happening over here? Oh, that caught on. Oh, we got to do that. Right?
Don't
take it personally. Right? You could have the greatest project in the world and it's not going to get made. Right?
Okay. And your younger brother, Russell Peters, he's known worldwide. What's something you've learned from him over the last 20 years as his manager?
Oh, that's fairly interesting in that he's much more open to people than I am. I'm much more likely to get pissed off about an individual or a person, right? And he's just like, that's just how they are.
Wow.
Right? And he's much more laissez-faire on that front than I am, right? But, you know, it's things like that. He'll have terrible road rage, and I'm just like, just relax, right? But then somebody will do something, and he'll be like, just don't worry about it. Just relax. Like,
hey, that's something good we could all learn.
Yeah,
right?
I've learned a lot from him in terms of being more open to people and new people coming into our lives.
Yeah.
He's much more open to that. I'm much more closed off. So that's something that I do appreciate from him. It's more like, just let's just see what happens.
Well, Clayton, thank you. Thanks for coming on the show, man.
Appreciate it.
That was fun.
Thanks
for having me. This. What did you take away from our chat today? I'd love to know. Let me know on Instagram at It's Not a Straight Line or connect with me on LinkedIn. If this episode was helpful, would you mind leaving me a review on whatever podcast app you use? I'd really appreciate it. You can always go back to previous episodes to hear more insightful conversations to help you build your own unique life. Thanks for listening to It's Not a Straight Line. Until next time.